If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes, or cutaway coat, perfect fits. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Tony, and you're listening to a brand new episode of Tales from the Couch Zone. And as always, I'm joined here by my co-host, Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent. All right. If you heard that musical intro, you know what we're talking about today. We're talking the passing of one Gene Wilder.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, we don't talk about every celebrity that sort of passes away, but why I thought we'd sort of mention Gene Wilder was when we do the rate and slate portion of the show, where we basically go through each year, look at the top 10 movies and pick a rate and one we slate. Both of us, I think actually it might have been the same year, both of us picked a Gene Wilder movie as our rate. Cause you chose, Young Frankenstein. And I chose Blazing Saddles.
Both excellent selections, by the way.
Yeah, but both great comedies and great performances. And it's one of those things that you it's not until you actually just sort of look at the his performances and just realize sort of how great he was at the stuff he do. Because the ones that he was they're quite demanding roles, and he brought like a sort of. He just brought a range to him. He had this sort of gentleness, but also this frantic comedy, like this madcap sense that he brought into Young Frankenstein. And in Blazing Saddles, which incidentally I did a bit of reading beforehand, and apparently that was like a last minute addition to that film, because there was somebody else who was meant to be playing that role of the Waco kid. And he basically, that actor got ill and Mel Brooks got in touch with Gene Wilder and said, can you take this part? We're desperate here. And he made that part his own, because it's just a really, wonderful performance. And of course he did all those films with Richard Pryor, they were a great double act together. But the performance that Aloys remember, and I think a lot of people will remember, was his turn as Willy Wonka in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was just, I mean, for a start, that film is, if you're going to list a top 10 of films that all children or families should watch of all eras, that should be in there. Because that is such a wonderful, timeless movie. And if you sort of, just the actual look of the film, it's sort of bright and colourful and everything, without it being over the top gaudy like the remake was. It's got that sort of like a real like innocent charm to it, with all the colours and everything. And it's just a wonderful film. I mean, the song in it where Gene Wilder sings about the being in a world of pure imagination, it's just a wonderful, wonderful, so uplifting film. And it's also got like this amazing, sort of satire to it as well. Because all the other children that go into the factory of Charlie, they all represent pretty much everything which was sort of like wrong with sort of society. And now, the greed, the ones who are basically lazy, the ones who are greedy and stuff like that. And it's still sort of relevant today. And it's just a great film. And also his performance in it is so great, because he's sort of charming and friendly, but at the same time he's got this like spooky and mysterious and sometimes quite creepy manner to him. I mean, throughout the film, as each kid basically sort of like, gets injured in his factory and basically, has all these like, nasty things happen to him, he basically doesn't give a shit. He's kind of really flippant with their fates and everything, and sort of makes joke on it. But it's just an absolutely amazing performance, that it is. And such a great film. His performance is so much better than what Johnny Depp did in the remake, which Johnny Depp, who basically pretty much just did an impression of Michael Jackson pretty much. But Gene Wilder, you know, just an absolute amazing, amazing talent. And when I sort of, when I would see him like in interviews and for, he also came as just like a really nice guy as well. You know, there was just something, you know, just something like a good, you know, a good sense about him. And he, you know, it's just one of those, like, you know, really, you know, really sad, but wonderful that he left us with so many, you know, great roles. Because, you know, the roles, he didn't do a massive amount. He'd been sort of missing from cinema for, like, you know, a long time. But the roles that he did, he absolutely owned those movies.
Yeah, you brought up the Pure Imagination song. I have a little bit queued up already. I'd like for the folks just to listen maybe like 5-10 seconds of it real quick so we kind of know where we're coming from.
In a world of pure imagination, take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. You look at most of his career, and for him to do a film like this just almost out of the blue, it seems a little odd. I'm curious to see if I can very quickly look up his past, because really I can't imagine an actor of his caliber with, I mean, obviously he did several movies and whatnot, but for a film like that with so much, I guess you would say, musical numbers and all the choreographies, I can't imagine him having that much with musicals in mind. Let's see if I can very quickly find this out. Yeah, another thing you brought up when you were talking about Gene Wilder's passing was the way that all the characters seem to signify a certain aspect of society that's unwanted. And I was doing some research, and I came across something that they sort of draw a correlation between the two. I guess Augustus would have been gluttony, Veruca would have been greed, Violet would have been pride, and Mike would have been sloth. So either there is a correlation there. You're not just pulling this out of your butt. I don't know if it was conscious, but it was one of those things you look back and it's like, wow, I didn't realize that was there.
I think if you actually know the source material, which, because I don't know if he's actually that well known in America, but Roald Dahl, who wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and he, you know, and wrote, you know, quite a few films like, you know, the Witches, James and the Giant Peach, Matilda. He's kind of like a, you know, a real English institution. It's like, you know, one of the most popular. One of the most popular sort of kids authors there's ever been. You know, in fact, this year it's an anniversary of his, so it's sort of like, you know, there's a lot of events going on in bookshops in the UK. But he, you know, that satire, it knowing Roald Dahl, that probably was deliberate. You know, the sort of morality that it was pushing on there, it was probably sort of, I'm pretty sure, was sort of pretty much a deliberate move by him, but also is a film where the writers actually, by adding and changing stuff in that film, made it even better, because a lot of the stuff that got, there's a subplot in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory where he there's a sinister figure basically offering a lot of money to anyone who can basically steal this chewing gum from the factory during the visit. And at the end, it turns out that basically that's a trick by Wonka, that basically Charlie basically has the chewing gum, but gives it back to Willy Wonka. And that's why he wins the prize. He wins the, you know, cause it shows that he's like a trustworthy person. Mm-hmm. And that whole subplot was actually added to the film. It's not in the original book. The original book's a lot more sort of, you know, lighthearted through all the, throughout the entire novel. So, and that's a case of where basically they added something, you know, that made the film even better. Mm-hmm. You know, cause when they did when you go back to the remake, they added a subplot which was basically explained Willy Wonka's entire origin, which you didn't need. You know, you basically, Gene Wilder in that film pretty much, You got a sense of this guy who was an eccentric and a loner, who couldn't fit in with society just by his actual performance. And that's what, you know, you didn't need to basically go any further, because you just by watching him and the dialogue and the way he acted with people, you got a sense of that's what the character wants. You know, you didn't need to have this really weird origin story where it turned out his father was a dentist, like they did in the Johnny Depp film. Mm-hmm. You know, so it just shows you the, you know, the difference in the time. But yeah, it was, you know, that whole film, it's one that I think, you know, all kids, can basically watch of all generations, because it is basically timeless.
Yeah, this is one of those things where often I wonder how well a film will translate to the next generation, how much they'll care. I think this is probably one that probably will hold to the test of time, because I'm thinking of films that I watched even before my time. It's like, I can't imagine there'll be films like that that'll stand the test of time, and they'll transfer to the next generation. Obviously, films like the one I can think off the top of my head is maybe like Wizard of Oz, which was, you know, decades before my time, but somehow I've seen, I have to imagine my younger nephews are maybe 10, 15 years younger than me. I'm sure if they haven't seen a film like that already, they probably will in their lifetime. So I imagine this is a film that may, I don't think it's gonna be stuck, you know, just a film that maybe film majors watch, or people that, you know, that study film or criticism. I think this is gonna wind up being a film that just winds up staying in the popular lexicon of pop culture. So I am glad it's going to stick around. So, all right, is there anything else you want to talk about before I move on to our next subject, Dazza?
No, just that's pretty much, you know, thank you, Gene Wilder, for the for the memories, and I didn't even talk about Blazing Saddles, which was my original choice for the rate, but it was, you know, it just, you know, again, just a wonderful career that the man left behind.
I feel like we could be here all day, Daz, if that's what we're going to do.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to go here and cover every single film he did, yeah. But obviously, we mentioned all the notable films that he done in his entire career. Speaking of long, I guess, pattern careers, let's talk about the career of one CM Punk, who next weekend will be having his debut MMA fight in UFC 203, right, Daz?
203, yeah.
Yes.
This is really weird. And it's not even before, you know, but today I sort of sat down and just basically like made a few bullet points of points I wanted to make. And it just seems really surreal that this is actually, you know, going to happen. But you know, if you were, you know, a couple of years ago to say that CM Punk would one day actually have a mixed martial arts fight on a UFC pay-per-view.
That's the thing that's odd to say, because I know I've listened to Dave Meltzer, the Wrestling Observer, and he talks about Dave Bautista's fight. And that sort of, you know, it makes sense, and it's one of those things to where he's not a professional fighter, so obviously the idea of him fighting in the UFC is absurd. So when you imagine in your brain maybe one day CM Punk branching out and maybe eventually doing a fight, you thought, oh, okay, well, he's going to fight in some third string, I guess, local Chicago-based MMA promotion against another guy who has no experience. You would have never thought in your wildest dreams that CM Punk would be making his debut fight against an up-and-coming fighter in the UFC in his debut in UFC. So it's one of those things to where it's like, I'm sort of there with you where it does sort of feel surreal. I understand why they did it. I understand why CM Punk chose to go in this direction. Because obviously, just the money's so good, you can't pass it up. But at the same time, it is kind of weird. Because, you know, you have these critics who are saying, oh, he shouldn't do it, and blah, blah, blah. And so they're so negative about it. And it's like, well, the guy just wants to do it. The guy has enough money to where he doesn't need to work another day in his life. So he's just doing this for fun. But at the same time, he's a guy who likes being in the limelight. And I'm sure he likes being paid oodles of money. So why not just do it in the UFC?
Yeah, I mean, The thing is, you can argue about the rights and wrongs of this, you know, for forever. But I have to admit, I am really interested to what's going to be happening next weekend. You know, because I'm interested to know what a guy who basically is, I don't know if he's past 40 or if he's reaching 40, who's never actually done any sort of legitimate athletic competition. Certainly, no actual sort of fighting background. What he's actually going to bring what happens after a year or so of training, and you know what is actually going to happen next week. And my you know, your instinct tells you that he's basically is going to sort of get knocked out, you know, within a minute. You know, because I've seen this Mickey Gall fight, and you know, he looks like he you know, like you say, he's an up and comer, but he looks like he knows what he's doing. He looks, you know, the fights I've seen, he looks comfortable in the cage. You know, he knows how to, you know, throw a punch, you know, everything like that. And I'm interested to see, you know, what is actually good when you take someone like that and see if, you know, it's almost like the My Fair Lady type, storyline where they basically, see, you know, they had a bet to see if they can take a common whore and turn her into a lady. You know, because, you know, wow. Can you take basically a pro wrestler and basically, and give it, you know, cause he is actually with, you know, a legitimate camp, mm-hmm. you know, and he, I think that's the difference between, you know, something like with Dave Bautista and stuff. He's with a legitimate camp. He's basically being trained by, you know, actual seasoned UFC fighters who are basically, you know, but they're kind of putting, you know, themselves on the line of it by doing this. You know, can you basically train someone like that in a year or so, to actually sort of be able to hold their own, you know, in a fight? I have to say, I kind of want the guy to win, basically because I know it would piss off so many diehards. If you, you know, because there's so many people who are basically, you know, mocking him for doing this and want, and basically who, you know, are offended by him being in there and want to see him knocked out. And I kind of want, even if he doesn't win, I kind of want him to make, you know, a good showing of this. And at the end of the day as well, some, you know, one thing about what he's doing is this is taking a lot of guts to, I mean, anyone who basically goes into a cage to basically fight and you're basically, you are practically putting your life on the line, you know, to basically go in there and basically, you know, be hit by, you know, another human being of your way, you know, you are basically, you know, putting yourself at risk doing that. And for him not only to, because I know, like you said, there's, you know, there's a lot of money that he'll be making. And, I don't know if you heard the press conference that went on a couple of days ago with Mickey Gall. Mickey Gall actually made a remark that he hopes that CM Punk actually, comes in overweight because that means he'll get 10% of what CM Punk's making. And he would like 10% of what CM Punk is making because he's making, you know, quite a bit of money. But yeah, it just sort of, you know, for him to basically be coming out there and doing this in front of the entire world, you know, MMA audience watching, because a lot of people are going to be watching this. People who are basically sort of like, you know, saying what a joke is this. They're going to be watching. They're not going to turn off the pay-per-view when he's on. And, you know, and to do this in front of, you know, a packed house and everything, I think the guy is really, you know, the guy, you know, has got guts doing this. You know, he's certainly more than Kurt Angle ever did, who basically was always talking how he was going to basically come into the UFC and stuff like that. I mean, it's weird. One of the things that's I found weird about this is, you know, if you're saying Dana White, none of them have really come out and sort of given like a good explanation of why they're doing this. I mean, you know why they're doing it.
Because it'll make money.
Because it'll make money, yeah. But normally Dana and everything, and granted we've not got the, I'm sure there'll be some specials this week and stuff, but you know, Dana normally is able to put a spin on things. And you know, and this one, they seem to have been quite quiet about this. It's just, I just find it really odd. But yeah, there's so much, you know, to me, this is something I am interested in seeing. You know, I want to see this, and it's just, but it is weird. It just feels a lot different from, because there's been other times when people are coming to the UFC and you could argue haven't really paid the dues or earned the way. I mean, when Brock Lesnar came in, he'd only had one fight. And he basically came into UFC and he lost his first fight and still had a world title fight two fights later. There was also the fighter that Randy Couture fought, the boxer who came in. But those were like, sort of like, there was interest in those and legitimacy because they had some sort of legitimate background in, you know, in fighting. And also Brock Lesnar, you know, he was such like a such a, you know, genetic freak, but sort of like, sort of, you know, an interest in what someone like that could do if we're brought into the UFC. But it's just with this one, CM Punk has got absolutely nothing. It's just a weird situation. I mean, I'm glad he's finally actually, you know, that he is actually getting a fight. Cause, well, you know, there was some sort of, there was some speculation, you know, and people saying that, you know, this was just a publicity stunt and that you would never actually see him, you know, in the cage itself. But, you know, he is going to fight. And but again, it's just, it just feels sort of really surreal. I think one of the weird things about it is that, you know, and I don't agree with this sort of, this argument people are saying that, you know, that UFC is, you know, that UFC should be the top, you know, it should be the pinnacle of it, of MMA, that you should basically have a legitimacy when you enter to get into the UFC, because it's basically, it's the biggest promotion.
Yeah, it's the biggest promotion because they put on the fights that people want to see that make the most amount of money.
Like, yeah, and it's also the richest. But throughout that sort of, you know, to me, I've no problem with them doing like little interesting projects like this, for, you know, from time to time. I mean, you know, the you know, that Mark Hunt versus, you know, Brock Lesnar was, you know, was that like, you know, a legitimate sort of, you know, if it was just a straight sporting contest, you know, is that a fight that you'd sort of, you know, that you would put together? They put on fights that are going to interest people and engage people. That's why people like, you know, Sage Northcutt and Paige VanZant are in there, because they've got some sort of like a look and a charisma that people are going to be interested in. And people are interested in following, like, you know, fighters on us, you know, who are basically sort of, you know, starting out and watching them grow and everything, and sort of building stars that way. And one thing that I've always liked about UFC over boxing is that if you go to a boxing card, you're just normally just going there for like, you know, one, maybe two fights. You know, and everything is just sort of, you know, nobody's. Whereas in UFC, they do try and basically big up everything on their card, whether it be putting like, you know, local sort of like, you know, guys on like their international shows, or if it's basically, you know, just sort of, you know, pushing guys who are sort of, you know, people who have that sort of, you know, charisma and putting them in key positions and bringing back, you know, sort of older fighters and stars, you know, like the, you know, the fight we had with Andrei Arlovsky and Josh Barnett, bringing back familiar faces. You know, they are very good at sort of putting on stuff that people want to see. And, it feels odd. And I actually wonder, you know, what CM Punk's actually, you know, what CM Punk actually hopes to get out of this going forward. Is this like a one-time deal, or is it just sort of, you know, you say it doesn't, you know, need the money, but everyone, you know, nobody's, you know, as Larry Holmes once said, you know, when they asked him why he was fighting Mike Tyson, he said, you know, a little bit more money never hurt anybody. You know, so it's a weird one, but I personally, you know, I will be getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning next week just to, you know, to watch that fight. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, very much so. And in fact, that's what you brought up a point earlier. The people that are being critical, that think, oh, this is CM Punk shouldn't be in there because A, he's not a professional fighter, and B, you know, he hasn't paid his dues. It's like, doesn't matter. If you feel so strongly about that way, then don't watch the fight. Like, really, say what you will, everybody wants to see it. And I think that's where UFC and CM Punk are looking to capitalize. And regardless of what your opinion is, there's opinions across the spectrum, whether you feel like it's a great decision by UFC or a terrible decision by UFC. The fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, you all want to see it. If you don't think this is a good idea, if you don't think this is a good business decision, you think this is bad for the sport, then put your money where your mouth is and don't watch it. But the fact of the matter is, everyone, you know, everyone listening to this is going to watch. Even if you're super critical of the decision and think it's bad for the sport, you're going to watch it. That's the number one thing I have to say. It's going to be an opening fight match. You're going to watch it. Everyone's going to watch it. Now, obviously, this is one of these fights where I too am excited to see where it's going to go. I'm looking at Mickey Gall's record here, and not really his record, but his background. And I don't know, Dazza, maybe you know more about Mickey Gall than I do, but I don't see anything as far as his background as far as being a professional MMA fighter is concerned. It's not like he has a background in martial arts or a background in collegiate wrestling. So I'm looking at him, and it's like, aside from being a couple of years younger than CM Punk, he's exactly like CM Punk. Just a guy who one day decided to start, you know, learning MMA, how to be an MMA fighter. Because I'm looking at his record. He doesn't have a background in boxing. He doesn't have a background in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. He's just a guy who just wanted to be an MMA fighter, learned all aspects of the game, and then just started fighting. And obviously, he's years younger than Punk. I'm looking at his age right here. It's 24. Let me see if I can find CM Punk's age. Guys, what were we going to say?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, he's just, you know, he has been involved in UFC in mixed martial arts longer, because he's had two, you know, fights, which obviously more than Punk's had, but he's also fought a couple of amateur fights, you know, so he basically, you know, knows his way, you know, around the cage, and he sort of, you know, he'll basically have sort of, you know, at the very least a rudimentary sort of, you know, of the skills, you know, he knows how to, you know, he knows how to hit. And he's basically going to have, you know, more experience, you know, as well as youth, he's going to have more experience, you know, going in there. I mean, he's a guy that I think probably feels like he's hit the jackpot, because his whole reason for getting into the UFC himself is early is because of CM Punk. Because the reason why he got this fight is that on the TV show with Dana White, where him and Matt Serra, they basically go around the country. And they basically go to these local MMA events and basically trying to find fighters who are basically they can bring into the UFC, which is where they found Sage Northcutt, by the way. You know, he was basically on one of these shows and they saw him and they thought, you know, this guy's got a lot, this guy's got potential, let's bring him in. And Mickey Gall, after he'd won his fight, he knew that Dana White was in the audience, and he basically just got on the microphone and just shouted, you know, give me CM Punk. And so, you know, so basically they sort of, you know, they liked his moxie, as it was, and they brought him in for this.
See, I would argue the opposite there, Dazza. I don't think he won the lottery. You know why? Because you look at the business for this fight. Now, obviously, when they're contracting, going back and forth, how much one fighter deserves, how much the other fighter deserves. Really, when you think about it, who's drawing the house here as far as this fight's concerned, as far as the money that's going to bring in? It's got to be Punk, right? So I can't imagine Mickey Gall's getting that much of a percentage, considering CM Punk's the one who's drawn in all the fight. And let's put this in the scenario of Mickey Gall as well. If you beat CM Punk, what do you gain? Okay, you beat a 39-year-old professional wrestler who has real no background in, you know, in the MMA game. But if you lose to CM Punk, that's it. That's a career. So it's
oh yeah, yeah, and yeah, but. Yeah, I get that if he loses, but he's basically got like a foot in the door in the UFC sort of a lot earlier. Because if you look at most fighters, most of them sort of, if you look at the sort of records when they make the debut, most of them sort of fought about 10 times, you know, before they go in. The women tend to get in a lot quicker, basically due to the fact that they're sort of fast track, because there's less opportunities for them on other shows to actually fight for. So somebody like Joanna Jędrzejczyk, for example, came in after only six fights and stuff. You know, so they tend to get in quicker. But somebody like Mickey Gall, he'd have a long wait before he gets into the UFC. And if he actually sort of, you know, if he beats Punk, which you would expect him to do, you know, even though there's no guarantees, that basically means that he's already had one fight at UFC. He beats Punk, he gets a fight there. And you would imagine that he'll basically get, you know, another fight off of that. You know,
yeah,
so.
But that's the thing, too. Who's he going to fight after he fights Punk? Is he going to fight a low tier UFC guy who has maybe, what, 10 fights under his belt? It's like, is that, like you said, if it were not for this Punk fight, he would have had a lot more fights left to go, and he would have had to work his way into the UFC. If he goes out there, beats Punk, let's say whatever, makes a name for himself, who's his next fight going to be against? And is he going to win that fight? Is that really the way you want to start your UFC career? Just, yeah, everyone remembers you from being CM Punk, but then you went on a rash of defeats because you weren't ready. You weren't ready to be on the main stage. You weren't ready to fight the best fighters in the world. I'm still of the idea this is a lose-lose scenario for Mickey Gall.
I don't think so, because basically people know who he is now. So provided he beats Punk, even if he was meant to lose his next fight and gets cut, people know who he is. So that kind of sort of means he can, you know, he has a lot more potential, you know, on the sort of, like, you know, on the independent MMA circuit, as it was. Because the fighters who are basically fighting the Ultimate Fighter, if they sort of, you know, get known, you know, you know, they'll basically be able to sort of, like, you know, they'll be more sought after to get fights and stuff, you know. So for him, it's sort of like, you know, I imagine he'll be sort of like, you know, making, you know, he won't be making a fortune of this, but he'll be making a decent enough payday, you know. So I think he's sort of, you know, done, you know, this whole situation, you know, is to his benefit, providing he wins.
That's the thing. No one brings up the fact that, because everyone just assumes CM Punk's gonna win or gonna lose. They never bring up the fact that what's gonna happen to Mickey Gall if he loses to CM Punk.
Well, you can look at it. But look at it this way: if he was to lose to Mickey to CM Punk, you would probably think, well, maybe he wasn't going to have much of a career in MMA anyway.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like, maybe.
But at least he gets a little bit of money out of it, and gets a name now.
But then it's like, if let's say he gets cut by UFC because he loses his next fight after being CM Punk, what's his claim to fame? Oh, you're the guy who beat the fake pro wrestler. Big whoop.
Oh, it could be the hero that basically rid the MMA of CM Punk.
Because it did so that moniker did so well for all the people that beat Brock Lesnar, right?
Frank Mir it did. Frank Mir has been living off beating Brock Lesnar for years now. Because he was kind of like, you know, a forgotten guy in the UFC, you know, his career looked to be done after the motorcycle accident and everything. And then after he beat Brock Lesnar, he became, world champion. He got to be on the biggest main event in the biggest buy rate UFC's done before Conor came along. So yeah, he basically, he certainly did Frank Mir's career. Pretty good.
Yeah, but all the other people who went in since beat Brock Lesnar, Cain Velasquez, like, really, you look at his fights out of even the championship fights that he's done, it's like those I haven't done particularly well. Alistair Overeem, if it wasn't for the fact that CM Punk was on this card, I can't imagine this pay-per-view doing all that great. It's one of these things to where, okay, you beat the guy, but who cares? The guy that's still the guy is going to draw. It's not like, you know, all of a sudden Alistair Overeem is this giant pay-per-view draw. It's like, no, it's still Brock. Still Brock's fighting UFC 200 and everyone cares because it's a big deal because Brock's fighting again. It's like, I don't know how well that translates long-term. It's like, maybe you might get a buzz for like a couple of months, but then after a while, it's just, well, you have to stand on your own work of, what you've done inside the cage. Another thing you brought up too was the idea of Brock Lesnar. He came in and even Frank Mir to a degree, they had maybe one or two wins and suddenly they got a UFC heavyweight title shot. You have to remember, this is UFC what, in 2007, 2008, I think it was. There was no heavyweight division. The idea that you could go out there and beat one guy and get a title shot, it's like, that's legitimate.
Yeah.
Even now you could argue to a degree, it's like the UFC division is, I mean, the heavyweight division is a little more, you know, I'd say it's more fleshed out, but I wouldn't say it's stacked. I mean, honestly, you could probably get a title shot in the UFC if you go out there and have maybe you beat two credible guys in the division, because it's a more fleshed out division, but still, of all the divisions they have in UFC, it's one of the thinner ones, no pun intended.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking heavyweights, you don't want to. All right. I think that's going to do it for this week's news. Let's move on to our next segment, Rate and Slate. Last week we did 1988. It only makes sense for us to close out the 80s with 1989 with the top 10 films according to TKO170.com, the top 10 movies according to the box office receipts. At number 10, Born on the 4th of July. Number 2, Ghostbusters 2. Number 8, the animation classic, The Little Mermaid. As long as we're talking family classics, Honey, I Shrunk the Kid. And at number 5, we have Lethal Weapon 2. Number 4, Dead Poets Society. Number 4, Look Who's Talking, Part 1. Number 3, Back to the Future, Part 2. Number 2, Batman. And at number 1, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. These are the top 10 films of 1989. Dazza, what is going to be your rate for the year of 1989?
My rate for this particular year is going to be the Back to the Future 2.
Okay.
And, yeah.
I'm always the guy who I don't praise that film. Like, obviously, when people think of that film, whenever it conjures up memories, people think of the beginning of the film. And I thought that's probably the best part of the film, because really you go in the second half of that film and it gets a little convoluted. Obviously, it was cool the way they sort of splice in the stuff from the first movie, but I thought that film suffered in being a little bit too complex in the second half. But Dazza, by all means, explain why you picked it for your rate. Of all the films you had this year,
I've got to say part of the reason is because I find this a particularly weak year. To me, it was between Back to the Future Part Two and Dead Poets Society, and Back to the Future Part Two. I just think it's a really really clever sequel. The stuff that I really love is just how it integrates and uses the time travel to mix in with the first film. I think it does it, you know, really, really well. And it's just a really clever how you've actually almost got two films going on. You basically, when he interacts with the first movie. And I just sort of, I just find as a sequel, I just found it, you know, like you say, you thought it was really complicated. I just actually loved it for that. You know, I love the fact, you know, because doing time travel a lot of the time can be quite tricky with all this, you know, the alternative realities and stuff like that and the science behind it. But I think this, that they just managed to sort of get away with it. And I love the ending as well, where it basically sort of like previews the, where he comes in after basically the end, pretty much after the end of the first film, and so to, you know, carries it, or, you know, the entire saga on into the next one. I just personally, you know, sort of really, really, you know, love this as a sequel. But like I say, to be perfectly honest, any other year that we've done in the past, particularly through the 80s, it probably wouldn't have made my rate. But to be perfectly honest, looking at the list, this is kind of a weak list for me, quite frankly.
I think weak is a little too extreme. I think some of these films are fine. Stuff that maybe I wouldn't necessarily pick out as my favorite of the bunch. But films like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, The Little Mermaid, obviously Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Back to the Future 2. These are all great films, Dazza. They're not obviously the creme de la creme, or if you're making a compilation of your favorite films of all time, these films are maybe not necessarily in there. But these are all still, you know, these are all solid films.
I think they're solid, but not ones that really blow me away. I'll be perfectly.
And for terminology that maybe you and a couple of my listeners won't maybe understand, these are B+ films. Would you not agree?
Yeah. A lot of them, but they're not what I would call sort of, you know, they're not absolute stinkers. I mean, they're still sort of, you know, it's still like a solid list. There's just nothing on there that, you know, in the past there's always been a couple of films which I thought, like, you know, are absolute classics that I've got to talk about. But for this list, there's just nothing on there that sort of I would sort of, if I was like to write my top 100 films, there's none on here which I would even, you know, consider, where most of the time the lists that we've gone through in the past, there's always been something on there that I've really, really wanted to sort of write, you know, really, really rate. And Back to the Future Part Two, you know, I like it as a sequel. I think it basically built on well from the last one, you know, by going to the future and everything, and just sort of, you know, it did what it needed to do. Generally speaking, this list, I mean, Lethal Weapon 2's, you know, is all right. Ghostbusters 2, you know, is all right. But, you know, this isn't a classic list. You notice as well, we're starting to get to the stage where it's starting to be, particular for this year at least, it's the sequels are starting to, like, you know, dominate the cinema somewhat, you know. But generally speaking, that's the one I rate. But if I'm not gushing about this one like I would the others, it's basically because this is kind of like a slim pickings for films that I would basically really, really, you know, rate.
Yeah, if I were to be objective here, at least as far as the films that I've seen, probably it'd probably be something like a Little Mermaid, which is an animation classic. But for me, since we've established long ago, this is purely a subjective thing. And obviously, like you said before, this is not emphatic. This is not like, oh, this is my favorite film. This is the film that, you know, if I'm doing a compilation of my favorite films of all time, it's up there. No, for me, I'm going to go with Batman. This is the first big comic book movie that I can really think of. Obviously, the Superman movies of the 70s, you'd probably want to put it up there. But this is the first big Batman movie. I remember watching this as a kid. I was a big fan of. This film has recently made its way to Netflix, and I've since rewatched it with sort of 2015/2016 eyes. And I kind of see why people are critical of this film, but I'm still of the impression that this is – it's a fairly good film. Sort of going back to our meme earlier that this is a year of B-plus films. And to me, this is a B-plus Batman, and I don't think it's particularly bad. I get the feeling Dazza has some words to say. Dazza, what do you think of Batman, the 1989 Tim Burton edition?
I kind of respect the fact that this was bringing back superhero movies. My problem with it is I remember being really disappointed with it because as a this, if I remember correctly, was round about the time that Dark Knight came out as a comic. And I remember people, and believe it or not, there was a bit of an outcry about this film because it was a lot darker than the old Adam West movies. You know, because basically that was, for many years, that what people just saw as being Batman, the people who weren't invested in the comics. And back in those days, you know, basically comic readership was more of a cult thing than it is today, and people were basically sort of appalled that this was sort of like, you know, a dark Batman film. But the thing is, when I went to see it, for me, it didn't go. And there was people talking about how this is Batman going back to his sort of gothic, you know, noir roots and sort of thing. But when I watched it, it didn't go enough in that direction for me. You know, it just sort of, it was kind of like a, it was sort of a bit darker, but it was still kind of the, it was still had the sort of, you know, the corniness of like, you know, the Superman movies. And I just sort of, I remember watching it and just sort of, you know, not being that impressed by Jack Nicholson's Joker. It, you know, to me, he was sort of, it was fine, but it was just basically Jack Nicholson dressed up. You know, and I just sort of, I remember just not being right, sort of like, you know, massively engaged with the story at all. You know, Michael Keaton actually thought was, you know, I really liked his Batman. You know, I think he sort of like, you know, did a really good Bruce Wayne and sort of like this really sort of, outsider type, sort of aloof, almost like a Howard Hughes type figure. And obviously we've sort of like, you know, this sort of like, you know, the death of his parents had sort of like, you know, weighed heavily on his mind. I think he did a really good role, which I think he doesn't always get his just desserts for this. But generally speaking, the film, I just wasn't, you know, it wasn't a thing that I sort of remember fondly or like that much, to be perfectly honest. I did like the sequel a hell of a lot more. You know, the next one with Michelle Pfeiffer and Danny DeVito as the Penguin, that one I enjoyed a hell of a lot more. But this one just didn't quite, you know, do much for me.
Well, we'll agree to disagree to a degree. Obviously, this is me saying this is my favorite of the 10 films here, but at the same time, like we said earlier, this is a year of the B-plus films. Although, when I'm looking at the list of other films that came out this year, ones that aren't in the top 8, there's quite a few notables in the top 50, obviously, that TKO170.com obviously gives. I'm looking at the list right here. You have All Dogs Go to Heaven Part 1. You have Roadhouse. You have Weekend at Bernie's. You have Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Major League. Pet Cemetery. Field of Dreams. Tango and Cash. Turner and Hooch. Looking at the Christmas Vacation. Steel Magnolias.
This is so 80s.
Well, this is the last year of the 80s, so I imagine we'll still probably get that when we go into 1990. When Harry Met Sally, other films in this, Driving Miss Daisy, License to Kill. So there's a lot more notables. If we had gone the top 50, I probably would have gone in a different direction, but I like the way that we establish this, the top 10, because really if we do top 50, we could be here all day listing off notable films, or it'd be hard to pick one film over another, and I think 10 is probably the best way to go.
I mean, the thing about the Batman is that, you know, despite my complaints, it is basically an 80s movie, and it is sort of in keeping with the stuff that was coming out in the 80s as it was. And I do get the, you know, the fact that this one sort of put superheroes back on the map, because it was a massive, massive success. And superhero movies, you know, I think if you sort of, you know, remember when we've been doing this, we've not basically had a superhero film to talk about for, you know, for a long time while doing this in the previous top 10. So it did sort of start, you know, putting superheroes back on the map. But, you know, as a film, it's just, I personally don't rate it, you know, as much as a lot of people do.
Okay. Since we've talked about our rates, let's talk about our slates, Daz. Daz, of these top 10 films, which of these top 10 do you think are the absolute worst of the bunch?
Well, my slate, and this is going to be a strange one, because it's not so much that I think this film is the worst of the bunch or even a bad film, but the one I'm going to pick is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Okay.
And the reason why I am going to pick this is basically just for one thing. And it's because I absolutely hate Sean Connery in this movie. the funny thing is, he seems to be the thing that people love about this film. Particularly at the time, people were sort of, you know, saying how he steals the show, how he out-acts Harrison Ford and everything. In case you've never seen this film, it is basically the weakest of the three Indiana Jones films. And there was only three Indiana Jones films, I should just point that out. He basically plays Indiana Jones' dad. And the tagline for this movie on all the posters was, he's back, and this time he's bringing his dad. And I just hated that concept, because I hate the whole thing of my action hero having daddy issues. Because that's what it is throughout this entire film. He's basically, Indiana is basically wanting that hug off his dad, because him and his dad never got along. His dad never paid him attention and stuff. And there's sort of this sort of thing going on the entire film. But Sean Connery is so annoying to me in this film. He's trying his best to be sort of cute and endearing, with calling them Indiana Junior all the time. And he's just, he just spoiled his presence in this film, spoiled it for me. I just absolutely hate it. I'm not the biggest Sean Connery fan anyway.
How
I think
dare
he was
you.
A great James. I know, don't get me wrong. I think he was a great James Bond. I think he was great. You know, some of his earlier films that he did, I liked him in Untouchables. I liked him in such films as The Man Who Would Be King, which he did with Michael Caine, which, if you've never seen that film, that is one that you should really check out, because it's a great film. I just got annoyed by the fact that he basically spent so much of his career pretty much just doing the same voice. Even when he's like doing like a Russian captain, he's still got the sort of a Scottish twang on. And I just sort of, he's kind of like seen as this, he's one of those sort of, you know, like Hollywood darlings, which is like almost, for want of a better word, untouchable to criticism. But the latest stuff from this point on, I've just never been a fan, or I found him, you know, really annoying. And yeah, in this film, I just really did not like him in this film at all. I just, you know, it was just, absolutely hated him in it.
Okay. Let's see. As far as, yeah, and then of all of the Indiana Jones is probably one of the weaker entries in the franchise, except when, you know, years later when we had Crystal Skull, but of the original trilogy, that's probably the
there was only three films.
Yeah. I said original trilogy. Oh, wait, what?
No, I'm just pretending that the fourth one never happened.
For me, I'm probably going to have to go with Ghostbusters 2. This is a franchise that had so much steam, that was so marketable, that has so much potential, not only in the box office, but outside of it. Something that's, people obviously look fondly. And the idea that this second film was so bad, or at least aspects of this film were so bad, that they stopped them from making a trilogy is sort of unforgivable. And obviously, as someone who's watched the film, obviously there's aspects of this film that are pretty good, but just really, especially towards the climax of the film, where it just completely goes off the rail. And it's like, you kind of understand now, obviously this is someone who didn't know, who had gone forever without watching the Ghostbusters films. And I watch, I'm like, why did they never make a third film? Because these are great. This is a great movie. This is a great franchise that has potential, at least for the very minimum, at least a trilogy. And you watch part two and you kind of know why it kind of just went off the rails and they never made a sequel to, because really, especially when you're talking about that climax when they're in the Statue of Liberty, it's like, wow. I don't know, Dazzle. What are your opinions on Ghostbusters 2? Because I'm obviously, there's some things that they played with in this film, and when people think of, when they think of fondly back on Ghostbusters, they'll think of certain aspects of this film. They'll cherry pick aspects of the second film. The way I would describe Ghostbusters 2, its parts are better than some. It explored a couple of good ideas, but the overall execution, the entire film of itself, was probably pretty poor.
I mean, they pretty much rehashed the first film. This is why I sort of liked Back to the Future as a sequel. They did something clever with it. They basically took the film, and they could have just done like a sort of, a film that just went into the future and hung around. They actually did something clever with the story and everything. In this one, they just did absolutely, nothing. It's practically once they get back together, it's practically the same film. Except that, you've not got a marshmallow man, you've got the Statue of Liberty. It's just, it's weak. And like you say, it did basically sort of like, end any hope of doing a trilogy. Although, to be honest, in nowadays, because it was still like, number 9 on the top 10. Nowadays, they would have still gone with a trilogy. Because if they would have seen it, like we've seen with the Transformer movies, despite what the backlash might be, if it makes money, they'll do another one. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of a change from them. But yeah, it's just sort of, it's kind of one of those films that is just kind of there. It was just basically a typical cash-in, uninspired sequel that you got a lot of, back in those days.
Okay. That's going to do it for our rate and slate of 1989. Let's compare our picks with what won Best Picture in 1999. Any guesses what it might be, Dazza, before I reveal it to our audience?
I'm guessing it's not anything on the top 10. Born on the 4th of July, I'm guessing that got nominated at least.
I don't think I have the nominations in front of me right here. Let's see if I can very quickly pull that up in addition. The nominees for Best Picture were, let's see, I have 1990. No, that's not it. Nope, can't find it. I just have the Best Picture, Dazza.
Okay.
The Best Picture for 1999. Obviously, we talked 1989. The way the Academy Awards, they always do it the year after. So what won Best Picture was, I mentioned it earlier when I was talking about the top 50 films, Driving Miss Daisy. Best Picture in 1990.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Go figure, Dazza.
Yeah, that's kind of... Yeah, I've seen that, and it's just kind of... I can see why it would win. Because in the 80s, it was kind of a film that basically sort of was, breaking down the sort of, the idea of a sort of a witch old white woman with sort of stereotypical opinions and sort of a black chauffeur sort of finding some common ground. I can see why that would appeal at that time. It's probably not a film that would basically be well received so much nowadays. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's one of those films that to me is just kind of there.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, luckily I had you talking for a little bit because I was able to look up the nominees. We could see if we agree or disagree with the direction they decided to go. Obviously, Best Picture winner was Driving Miss Daisy. But like you mentioned earlier, Born on the 4th of July was also a nominee. Dead Poets Society was also a nominee. Field of Dreams and the last is, My Left Foot. So those were the Best Picture nominees for 1990.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine, Born on the 4th of July, it's, like I said, it's a film that I would expect to get sort of nominated, but we'd sort of pass the Vietnam films by that time were sort of like becoming a bit sort of, we'd had them for a few years. So I can imagine why that didn't actually win. Cause I think Platoon won a few years back. So it's probably, but the politics were kind of, we've had a Vietnam film win a few years back. So we're not going to, have another one, but, Yeah, again, that list is kind of, you know, just sort of, you know, just there, basically.
No. All right. Since we talked,
I mean, out of that list, which ones would you like?
Driving Miss Daisy is one of these films where I guess it was of its time in the 90s. I can see why they would decide to go in that certain that direction. And this also suffers because I've also never seen some of these films. Dead Poets Society, I have to imagine, I'd probably go with. Although Field of Dreams is pretty good too, but that's sort of like, I don't know, you know, it's one of those things where it's a good movie, but I don't know if it's a best picture worthy, but it's certainly worthy of a nomination. But yeah, I'm right there with you. Dead Poets Society is probably the direction I would have gone in. Sorry, I was researching this film I never heard of, My Left Foot.
Yeah, that's one about the handicapped guy who can't communicate.
Oh, okay. So yeah, yeah,
it's I've seen that. It's not exactly a laugh a minute.
Well, no, but you know what? To be a great film doesn't necessarily always have to be a laugh a minute, Dazza.
Well, no, but I'm saying it's kind of a not one that you sort of put on if you fancy a laugh. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Unless you're really, really sick, in which case, you know, maybe. I'm sure Coughlin will be able to find it a step.
I wouldn't doubt it for a second. In fact, probably when this conversation's over, I'll probably hit him up.
Yeah.
You sick bastard. All right. We talked the best of the best. Let's talk the worst of the worst. At this point, they've gotten to the 10th annual Razzies, a complete decade, Dazza, of the Razzies Award. They established them in 1979, so now we're here at 1989. Let's look at worst picture.
And remember, we have to confess as well if we like these films.
This is true. All right. Let's look at these films. I'm going to mix them up, and then you have to guess which is the worst, Dazza.
Okay.
All right. Worst picture from 1989. From Columbia Pictures, we have The Karate Kid Part 3. From TriStar, we have Lock Up. From United Artists.
Oh, I like Lock Up.
But Dazza, you're supposed to do that later.
Okay.
That's fine. United Artists, we have Roadhouse. From Orion, we had Speed Zone. By the way, Orion, whatever happened to that studio? Did they wind up getting bought up by somebody? Let's see if I can find
probably. I think there's like one company that owns them all now anyway. I'll
research this up later. And Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. So those five films, Dazza, which was the worst? Do you need a reminder?
No. Well, I can say what I personally think. I have to say, of all the times we've been doing the Razzies, this is the first time when I think I've actually liked more than I've disliked. And actually, I think this list is quite bullshit, to be perfectly honest.
I'll go
into that later. But the one that I would choose from that list as being the worst is easily Star Trek V.
You would be correct, Dazza. That would be the worst picture for 1989.
Yeah, that's one with God. Well, a guy pretending to be God, The Search for God, as it was, with Shatner doing his, what does God want with a starship? which, admittedly, that's probably the highlight of the film, but that film is absolutely, it's almost like somebody who didn't know how to write a film was writing a film. It was just basically, it was almost like they were making it up as we went along. It was no real coherence to it, but, you know, the storyline didn't make any sense at all. It was just kind of, you know, yeah, you have the weird, you know, siege on the planet, and then the Enterprise getting taken, and then, you know, this search for God in the center of the universe. It was just a really, really bizarre film. I think this was didn't Shatner direct this one?
Now let's see if I can very quickly investigate this. It wouldn't for the least a bit surprise me. Directed by William Shatner, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because Nimoy, he this is probably sort of like the thing, because Nimoy, he directed, I think he directed the fourth and third one. And then this was probably like Shatner sort of, because if you ever read any biographies about the making of Star Trek, there was like real rivalry between sort of, well, particularly on the side of William Shatner, who didn't, you know, but there was this thing where he basically had to make sure that he was always in the shot, stood in front of Leonard Nimoy. I read this once this guy took a script to William Shatner, and William Shatner is reading the script and he basically was counting something. And then he went back and started reading it and was counting something else. It turned out he was counting how many lines he had and how many lines Leonard Nimoy had. That was sort of thing. So this was probably a thing that they, well, Leonard Nimoy's directed one. I want to direct one. So, you know, he was, but yeah, this was a complete mess as a film. It's absolutely terrible. You know, this is one that just, it felt like somebody who never really understood Star Trek or even stood like, you know, film writing at all, made, just a really bad one. Easily, I don't know if it's the worst because it's hard to sort of, you know, compare it with the first Star Trek, the motion picture, but it's certainly, you know, it's certainly neck and neck, shall we say.
All right.
I have to say, I think this list is pretty much, I question this list because
you have to think, Daza, they're also in the scenario where they have to pick something. They can't just say, "Oh, all films were great this year. We're not having the Razzies."
Yeah, I know, but Roadhouse.
Well, they also have to pick films that everybody knows. They can't pick the worst film of 1989, some art house picture that nobody saw. It's like you got to go with the big pictures, and you have to do it every year. So I have to imagine the nominees aren't worthy.
Well, okay. I mean, right. Okay. Well, I mean, I confess, I like Roadhouse. I think Roadhouse is great. I think it's a lot of fun. Karate Kid Part 3 is not great, but I mean, it's okay. You know, it's if I'm correct, that's the one where he basically, where he joins the camp that he was fighting in the first film, but they're tricking him because he thinks that the original guy who led it's dead and he's not. It was sort of, you know, I thought it was okay. It wasn't great, but it was okay. And what was the other one? Lock Up.
Yes.
I thought Lock Up was okay.
Yeah.
Karate Kid 3. It was an over-the-top Sylvester Stallone prison movie, but you know, it was fine. It's watchable. You know, there's some sort of like, you know, real drama. Donald Sutherland's pretty, you know, good in it as the prison warden. You know, and there's sort of like, you know, a decent enough action movie. So, yeah, and there's a couple of good fights things. I think this is, if you notice as well, I think Stallone was basically, obviously, he was in the headlights of the Razzies at some point. I'm just looking at the list of the, I've got to admit, I don't know Speed Song. I'm just looking at the list of the other films in this year, you know, for worse ones. I personally think Look Who's Talking's a worse film than any of those.
How dare you?
Oh, God, yeah, it's an awful film.
I see, you know, Daz is a bitter old man.
Oh, yeah, look Who's Talking's awful. I'm so good. Weekend at Bernie's pretty sick.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's kind of a wacky classic.
They made a sequel.
Yeah.
You'd think it was starting to sniff or smell a bit by then. No. What else is there? I'm looking down the list. The Burbs. I put that in there. Yeah, but Pet Cemetery, I didn't think it was particularly, you know, great.
I've seen it and it's not a great film, but you know, it's not a Razzie award winning, but like we said, this is probably what most of this list probably is, just these films where they had to put something on the list.
Yeah, but of them all, I will stick up for Roadhouse the most. And I think a lot of people will, because Roadhouse is, let's face it, the remaking the film, it's kind of like, to me, it's this is a film that was basically epitomizes this sort of the Friday night rent-a-video era. You know, it's not a film that you would feel great going to the cinema to see, but it's a decent enough film that you would basically rent from a video store. And this is the generation that this was. So, you know, I will stick up for Roadhouse.
All right. We'll do what we always do. We did this special thing for the worst picture, but then I'll very quickly rattle off what won. Worst actor was William Shatner in Star Trek V. Worst actress with Heather Locklear in Return of the Swamp Thing, which I didn't know was a thing in 1989.
That's a bad adaptation.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Let's see. Worst director since we brought it up earlier, William Shatner in Star Trek V.
Deserved.
And one I think that's absolutely not deserved. For worst original song, Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter for Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child by Bruce Dickinson. How dare they? Where did they get off?
Well, it's actually Iron Maiden.
That's why I said, where did they get off? It's like, that's a good Iron Maiden song. Where did they get off?
I got a story about that song.
Ooh, let's pull up. Story time.
Yeah, in the UK, Iron Maiden was, because this is back in the days when the pop charts was like a really big thing, when basically everything just went on record sales. None of this sort of manipulation through downloads or any of this sort of thing. It was like it was basically a genuinely interesting chart. And very few, Iron Maiden were this band where, because most songs, what we would do, if we would go into a chart at a certain level, and then they would sort of, gradually go up the chart within a few weeks, and then sort of, drop down. Very few songs ever made it straight into number one. Nowadays, if a song's going to be number one, it normally goes in straight away. And most rock bands, your Def Leppard, your Guns N' Roses, that sort of thing. They rarely got into like the top 10 because basically all their sales were to do with albums, those bands. The singles didn't basically, translate into sales. They did well, but they were never like top 5 hits and stuff. The exception was Iron Maiden. And because Iron Maiden had such a strong, loyal fan base, what used to happen is if they released a single, the single would go into the top 5 every single time, because all their fans would buy it on the first week. And then it would basically drop down, really, really quickly. But it was just kind of that thing that they weren't really that bothered, because it was basically, it was the charts, and the charts were more pop orientated, sort of thing. But it was always a thing that sort of like, when an Iron Maiden song was always this thing, like, because they were going sometimes at number 3 and stuff, and you'll think, it's possible that, one day they could get a number one single. So what Iron Maiden actually did is, in the UK, the big thing is the Christmas number one. It's, to get the Christmas number one. That's when all your songs come out. And the week after the Christmas number one, pretty much no one releases songs, because it's basically, because it's a quiet time. People don't tend to buy singles, straight after Christmas. People sort of, are buying albums. And also, it's just sort of like, the race for the Christmas number one is done. So no one really released any sort of songs. So what Iron Maiden did, which was quite sneaky, is they basically released Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter the week after the Christmas number one. And of course, what happened is, which always happens, is all the Iron Maiden fans went out and bought it. So it had the big, massive sales. And it basically beat every single other song that was sort of in the chart at that time, because we'd all, the sales had sort of slipped because we'd all been chasing Christmas number one, and it went in straight in at number one. And the real, and the real, but this sort of created another problem, because in the UK, the tradition is that the radio shows, they will all play the number one song for the week. And with that, and most of the radio shows refused to play it because it didn't fit in their thing. So it immediately outraged all the Iron Maiden fans, who were saying, hold on, it's the number one. Why isn't it being played? And it sort of created a whole sort of like, backlash against the charts and everything. But that was sort of, that was Iron Maiden, getting the, manipulating things a little bit and getting the number one single for the week.
Nice. But you've heard the song, right?
Oh yeah, it's one of the it's one of their worst songs, I think.
it's a fairly decent song, Dazza.
It's basically the average Iron Maiden song. It's nowhere near as good as say Run to the Hills or Stranger in a Strange Land or what was the other one? Can I Play with Madness? It's nowhere near as good as those.
Someone just bought himself an outro song this week. but yeah, I'm looking at this list, and really, when it comes to as far as all the nominees for Worst Picture or Worst Supporting Actor or Worst Supporting Actress, there's nothing that really sticks out. None of these films, I obviously done this in the past where I'll defend a film and I'll be like, well, I particularly like that film. No, I'm looking at this list. It's kind of, you know, they're not horrible films, but at the same time, it's not like one of these where it's my, I secretly like this film. It's a guilty pleasure. No, it's not really that. So. All right.
I like Roadhouse.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Since we got that out of the way, Dazza, what have you been watching as of late since we're talking all things film?
Well, I managed to get to a cinema a couple of times this week. I've not for the past 2 weeks. I managed to catch up a little bit. I went to see, I just forgot what I went to see. The Purge Election Year.
Oh.
Which I enjoy. I actually really enjoy the Purge films. I like the concept of basically everything, you know, turning into anarchy for one night of the year, and basically the first one was sort of okay, but it was kind of just sort of a concept, you know, set in this suburban house, and I don't think it did enough with the concept. The second one I really, really liked, and this one I liked as well. It just sort of, it took the the second film and basically put more of a sort of like a political edge to the film, obviously, sort of, you know, because of what we got this year. And it was just kind of like a fun action film. I always, these films have always got like a real tense tone to them when we're sort of counting down to the Purge starting, and and everything, and then basically everything sort of, you know, going to hell. It wasn't a great, you know, film by any stretch of the imagination, mm-hmm. but, you know, as a sort of, as an action film, I do enjoy the concept behind these films. You know, I think there's, you know, a little bit of politics and satire in them. And, I did enjoy this film. And the another film that I didn't actually go to the cinema to watch, but I went to, on Netflix. A film I've been meaning to watch for ages, actually, called The Last Stand. With Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh dear.
Which I actually enjoy this. It has to be said that Schwarzenegger was really, really bad in this film. Even more so than normal. I think it's because this was a role that meant he had to do a lot more talking, and he wasn't doing like the, the all out action hero role. This was one where he was played like a small town sheriff and stuff, but it was sort of, it was bad, but almost endearingly so. It was just sort of, it was kind of really odd. You sort of, you know, but when he was delivering lines and when he was sort of acting and trying to do these things, like when he's like watching somebody about over the street or he's suspicious of, his expression was almost like somebody said to him, man, now you've got to act suspicious. I mean, he just did the most suspicious looking face that he could do. You know, it was just really, really bad in there. But the whole thing, I found was quite fun. It felt like an old A-Team type episode where you would have sort of like a small town in the middle of nowhere where a load of bad guys were about to descend on the town. And so the town people, like the sheriff, you know, the small sheriff crew and everything, they had to basically set things up and defend their town the best they could. And it was just sort of, it was just kind of fun. It was kind of, you know, it's not a film that I would have wanted to have seen in the cinema, but for just sort of to watch after work on Netflix, it was kind of like that sort of, you know, again, like Roadhouse, a video rental type movie. And then another film I went to the cinema to see. I went to see a film called Pop Star Don't Stop Ever Stopping.
Oh yes. Oh, I haven't seen it, but I know what it is.
Yeah. It was a comedy and it was okay. It's a weird one. It's one of these films that it would probably have done better as like a half hour or hour TV show. There were some genuinely really funny bits in there, but it was more sort of like a clever type funny as opposed to a making you laugh out loud funny. There was some really good stuff in there. I mean, the concept is it's basically a documentary about a sort of a clueless pop star who's basically, it's almost like a Justin Bieber type. But it's basically like his documentary on him reaching the top and then having this massive, absolutely fall from grace when he releases a bad album. And there's some really good things. I mean, there was one bit in there that was where he did this, this like music video where he did a song that was basically in support of gay marriage. But as he's singing the song, he keeps pointing out that he's not gay himself. And he, you know, and he keeps singing about sports and like women and stuff like that. Just so you know that he's in support of gay marriage, but he's not. It was just really funny how it was done in this film. And he had Pink in there doing the duet with him. And Pink was just sort of like, you know, kept giving him this look. It was really funny. It's a strange film because it never became like bad or boring. But it was only a 90-minute film, and it just felt a lot longer. And it's again, it's not that it was bad. I just felt like I'd been in for about 2 hours when I looked at my watch. I thought, I realized I thought it had only been a 90-minute film, and it just sort of felt longer. But it's a good comedy if you sort of, you know, and it absolutely rips into the sort of, you know, the celebrity stars of today and stuff like that. But it was by no means as good as, say, Spinal Tap. It didn't reach that sort of thing of cleverness. It was just sort of, it was a funny film in stages, but it wasn't something that I was sort of, it wasn't as great as I was hoping it was going to be.
Oh, that's a disappointment. Okay. If you're reading anything as of late, it's been that you find particularly good.
Well, unfortunately, I've not been able to get to any comic shops.
It's okay. You know what? I have something sort of to make up for that fact. This weekend was the Harvey Awards, and among notable winners were Best Newcomer Tom King. Obviously, I don't know if you're actually you are familiar with Tom King since he writes the current Batman series. He won net Best Newcomer.
Oh yeah.
But for Best Comedic Writer, you'll never guess who won, Dazza.
Best Comedic Writer.
Mm-hmm. Which they lovingly say worst new writer or worst writer.
Bendis? Yeah,
it's tongue in cheek. It's for the comedic person.
Okay. No, I've no idea. Go ahead.
Chip Zdarsky, the current writer of Howard the Duck.
Well, you've lost me. As worst writer,
that's what they call the award, but it's tongue in cheek for the best comedic writer.
Oh, right. Okay, I've got you. So yeah. Oh, that's cool. I'm fine with that. That is a comic I've absolutely been loving. You know, so you know, but I've said before though, the comedy comics. Then you know they are my sort of favourites at the moment. I mean, that one, Gwenpool and Harley Quinn. You know, they're the ones that give me the you know the most pleasure. So yeah, I'm cool with that.
All right. Is there anything else that you want?
I have to go back. I have actually been reading something which might be of interest. Basically, I've been reading I've finished reading a novel called Kung Fu by Ryan Gatiss.
Ooh, nice.
Which is a really, really fun, really dark action novel. This is one of the few times when a sort of a film type concept has actually worked in a book form, because the concept is that there's basically this really, really rundown inner city school where pretty much everybody in this school does some sort of martial arts. And basically this gang warfare is rife throughout this school. And basically everyone is basically has to be forced to be in certain gangs and stuff. And it's just like a really fun, I won't say fun, that sounds too chivalrous, a really great action book. And the last 100 pages or so are pretty much sort of to do with like a riot that breaks out at the school. And it's almost like watching the last half hour of what you would call a Bruce Lee chop socky film. Absolutely, you know, basically describes all the fight moves and everything like that. Just really, really, you know, incredible book. So Ryan Gatti is actually a really good author. He writes sort of like really gritty, but also with a little bit of a pulp theme crime novel. And this one, this, if you are into martial arts at all, or into martial arts movies or anything like that, I really would recommend this book, because it's got a really over the top, pulpy type martial arts feel to it. And it's just, you know, a really good book that I would recommend.
All right. That's cool. All right. Is there anything else that you want to talk about that you've been working on as of late? Either something that we need to check out, or is there something you're working on as of late that we should check out in the future?
I've just posted, which hopefully will come out sometime this week. I've posted another Full Britannia piece. This one about a TV show in the UK called The Interceptor, which ran for one season in the 80s. It was basically a game show, which I describe it in the article better than I can here. But basically, it's competitors out in the countryside trying to find clues to, while being chased by a guy in a helicopter with a laser gun. So, you know, and this was basically a show that I watched as a kid and thought was absolutely great. But it's a kind of like a real 80s, I think it was 89 when it came out. So a real 80s bizarre English TV show that sort of helped people would, we'll read and sort of, you know, enjoy. And also my other piece that I wrote last week, which I forgot what it actually was.
You fool!
Sorry?
I said, you fool, you're doing us all.
I know, I'm a fool. But basically, if you look up on Half Guard, there is a piece that I had uplift. I think it was the ROM Space Knight one, but I previewed.
Ooh, yeah,
last
you
week.
Did an updated one. You talked about it last week, but yeah, I read it. It's a great read.
Yeah, yeah, that's one. I've also got, hopefully this week, top 8 or 10, I can't remember what it was, arse kickings that I did. That's not gone up yet, but hopefully that should be going up this week. Otherwise, Coffin will get an arse kicking.
Maybe he's waiting for UFC 203 to happen before he strategically posts that.
That may well be the absolute arse kicking.
You may have to make an update to that list.
Possibly, yeah.
All right, Des, unless there's anything you want to talk about, I think we're going to start to wrap things up.
Nah, I'm pretty much done.
Okay, so from all of us at halfguard.com, thanks for checking out this week's show. And as always, see you guys next week. Adios.
Bye. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal. You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
You've earned it, Dazza.
Honey, it's getting close to midnight.
All right, that'll do.